Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. Remind you, on our way to this conversation, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we're in our second hour. Good to have you here with us. And we are about to have a conversation on what's happening in our local world here in Baltimore and Maryland. We're joined by Dr. Lawrence Brown, public health consultant and assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Phil Tran, political and consultant and CEO of Phil Tran Public Relations, LLC, and Dr. Ronnie Ellington, associate professor of mathematics education here at Morgan State University and a community commentator here on The Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you all here.
An upgrade.
Morning.
Upgrade.
That means something. I'll put that on my
That's right.
I'll put that on my card now.
That's it. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts and ideas. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. So please do join us here. Let's start out with, on this conversation here this morning, the Freddie Gray case is going to be coming up. We'll be covering it a lot. Tomorrow we will have Dwight Pettit and Bill Colbert coming on the program, two of our esteemed lawyers in this community and law professor to talk about the case. Doug will be calling in from the case on Wednesday. He'll be at the hearing to give us live reports here on the show about what happened. And, of course, we'll be covering it on Thursday post-mortem because it really is a very critical view. But let's look at that. Right now they're going to be deciding, A, whether or not they're going to try to recuse – whether or not State's Attorney Mosby will be recused from the case, not allowed to participate. And B, will they move the venue? Mm-hmm. So – and we also have the volatility of all this inside the community. Lawrence?
Well, you know, this is a turning point, I think, for Baltimore, yet another one. You know, specifically after we've seen the city create a war room, after we've seen the sort of repression of the dirt bikers, and the mobilization, the militarization of the police with the increased spending and allocation for riot gear. I think we're setting ourselves up for another explosive situation because I don't think our police force has learned how to de-escalate and to deal with protest correctly. And so I think that this case poses yet another challenge with the volatility in the community because we've never addressed the trauma, the unresolved grief that exists within disinvested redline black communities surrounding this case. And we haven't really engaged, the police have not, the city leadership have not engaged with the residents in a process of healing that unresolved trauma, that unresolved grief. And so it's still there, it's still palpable. And I think we may see, especially if this trial is moved, like Rodney King, when they moved that case outside of L.A. County to Sonoma Valley, that was a recipe for disaster.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The recusal of Mosley issue, that may not touch the nerve, but if this case is moved, I'm telling you, mark my words, something's going to pop off. Because the question is, what is the rationale for the move? And can police who do damage in a community be tried by that community and be fair? And if this is moved, what we're doing is sending a message to say, we're going to move you. We want to make sure our police are protected in certain kinds of ways. And I don't think that's going to go over well in the community. So the recusal of Mosley, I'm almost certain that's going to happen. You can put my prediction in that they're going to recuse her and she's not going to be able to participate in whatever way. But if they move this venue, yeah.
Phil Tran.
Well, it's just very important to make sure that we have a fair trial, regardless of the circumstances. We want to make sure that we have all the facts that are surrounding the case. And
what do you mean by fair trial? Because trials are governed by people's perceptions of who's being tried. That's one of the issues that's coming up a lot.
Exactly.
So can people who kill unarmed black people get a fair trial? Like, what does that mean?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that a lot of times trials have already been decided in the minds of the public. And whether they have decided to go one way or the other, the media can influence the way a trial goes.
But that's so, with all trials. So then we say no trial is fair. Go ahead.
Yes.
I'm listening.
Yes. Okay.
I really want to get what you mean, because people use that word about fairness when they're thinking of moving something they think is not going to be fair, when in fact we know that most trials in this country are not necessarily fair because they're given by perceptions of
right.
the people involved.
Exactly. And in some other cases, they've had to move the venue of the trial because they felt that the location of the trial could prejudice the outcome of the case one way or the other towards certain parties.
But I think, you know, to that point, if suburban areas are disproportionately white due to a long history of social engineering by the federal government, so it's going to be biased if you move
right.
the case out to Montgomery County, Howard County. I mean, those are areas where the police will never be convicted. So I think the police are... The public has such a positive view of the police that they wouldn't even be willing to doubt or question the police side of the story. So I think, you know, there's a danger if we're saying fair.
Mm-hmm. That's
what happened with Rodney King. They moved it out to some suburban area where Rodney King wasn't going to have a jury of his peers mm-hmm. judging the police for their actions. So I think, you know, we do have to be careful with that notion of fairness mm-hmm. because I think we absolutely swing towards a demographic that will never convict the police in that area. And those officers should be tried in Baltimore City by a jury who both received their policing and by a jury who receives the impact of that brutality.
Phil, you want to comment again before we open the phones on this issue?
Go ahead and open the phones.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Kenneth, line one.
Hello, Mark. How you doing?
Good morning, Kenneth.
Always a pleasure. You know, if WEAA go back and play some of the things, predictions that I've made over the years, you know, it will see a lot of validity in what I'm talking about. And so what the point I'm trying to make is, of course they're going to do something to disturb this trial. This is probably going to be one of the biggest trials in America or in the world, you know. They're not going to lock those, three or four white guys, cops, that killed Freddie.
Half the police, it was a mixed group.
Here's what's going to happen. Like you said, they're going to try to find a way, just like they did with the freeway, got those two guys that were killing people up and down the Eastern Seaboard. They moved their trial from Maryland all the way down to, I think it was Georgia or Alabama.
Virginia.
So that they could get the death sentence. But in this case, they're going to move that trial because they got different laws in different states. I don't know where they're going to move it, but just like the lady said, they're going to move it away from Mosby, you know, and they're going to move it away so they'll have different laws for this case. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. Let's talk a bit about that. I mean, going back to history again, with the case of the Beltway sniper who was talking about. That case was moved to Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, our former attorney general, who was then the state's attorney for Montgomery County, was very clear he wanted the case because he was also seeking the death penalty. It wasn't as if he wasn't going to seek the death penalty. Let me be clear, but they moved to Virginia first. Though here in Maryland, they would have gone for a capital case as well in that case. So, but in this particular case, what we're talking about is stopping Marilyn Mosby from leading the prosecution mm-hmm. in court. This is before Judge Barry Williams. He'll make this decision coming up. And whether or not these officers will be tried together and whether or not this will be tried in the city of Baltimore or will be sent to some other place like Worcester County on the Eastern Shore, which is one of the places people are considering that it would be sent. Which is one of the arguments I've heard from some of the defense attorneys is where it should go. This is a very critical moment about where this case is going, how it's going to be handled, and who's going to handle the prosecution. The prosecution will still be handled by Baltimore, but it'll be in a different county if it's taken out. The prosecutor's not changed. Mosby might have to sit out, but But the process, but it would be in a different place.
So then what's the purpose of moving it? See, that becomes, because, you know, we cloud things under fair trial. That's why I asked the question. I really wasn't trying to be facetious. We use words like fair and unprejudiced, and the media is shaping opinion. These are all, this is happening no matter where this trial is. So I'm just trying to get at the, what is the rationale for the move? I definitely understand the rationale for moving Mosley out of the key prosecutor position, which I don't necessarily agree with the rationale, but at least I kind of understand what they're doing with that. But I don't get why this is being, or even being considered to be moved, if we're having the same prosecuting team, if all the whole country has been impacted by the Freddie Gray case. So if we're saying the media is going to prejudice jurors, that, I mean, this is a national case. It got national publicity. So I'm just trying to understand the thinking. And I think I have my own ideas of the thinking, but we're going to leave that alone.
410-319-8888. Phil or Lawrence, want to jump in before we go back to the phones?
Well, in my mind, there's no other rationale but a political one, which would be to, it would be akin to saying that Baltimore juries are incapable of delivering and rendering a fair verdict
exactly.
in this case. And I think that would be a slap in the face of Baltimoreans. I actually think recusing our sister state attorney would be a slap in the face as well, because that is to say that somehow she's unfit, unintelligent, incapable of rendering a fair prosecution in this case. And I think that would be utterly foolish as well. She's very qualified. She's done a tremendous job. And she should be able to stand in and prosecute this case.
This judge may also, we may not get the ruling until much later. It might not come till Friday, might not come till Monday, because I think the judge is going to take some time to see where this is going. They refer to him as a thoughtful judge. I don't know much of his work, though. He's done a lot of stuff. He's been on the bench for a long time. Your thoughts, 410-319-8888. This is going to be key to some volatile moments in the city, what could happen in response to this, and your ideas, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Kadria, line 3. You're on the air. Kadria, you there? Hello? Are you there?
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Kadria, could you turn your radio off so we could hear you better, please?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
Good morning. Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Sure.
Listen, this is nothing but a smokescreen. Your female guest on there hit it right on the head. How can you have a fair trial with people who have been unfair to us for 400 years, have no intention of letting us go, have no fairness in this country? The whole idea is that, she said it, the blacks are out of control in this country. They don't control nothing. What was the Tea Party's cry? Let's take our country back. Back from who? Back from a black man in the White House, okay? So we're fooling ourselves to think that we can expect fairness from these people. It's not part of them. Not part of them.
Thank you, Andrew. I mean, well, the question is, now the other side can say the same thing. They could say, on this process, and the prosecutors are saying, that how can the police receive a fair trial in Baltimore where the majority of citizens will look at the police as part of the problem? Can they receive? That's what they're going to argue, that this is why they cannot receive a fair trial in the city. Not because they're white, because they're in blue.
Well, okay. So they argue that, but what's the basis for that? What's the basis that any cop has been indicted and prosecuted on killing black people? Like, I don't get they can't get a fair trial. Clearly, it's evidence that they get fair trials all the time, and they get trials that are in their favor. So that argument just sounds real abstract to me, because you don't have any real evidence that that's even the case, because nobody's getting indicted. Nobody's. What are you talking about? That would be my answer to that.
Bill? You're being uncharacteristically very quiet here. Well, what's going on?
Because the issue here is that you don't want to have somebody already convict somebody before they've actually went into trial. And what the defendants here are trying to protect themselves from is from the court of public opinion that has already decided that they're already guilty without knowing all the facts of what happened inside that police van, everything else that could be mitigating factors, who actually is actually guilty among the six people who were involved. So that's what they're seeking to accomplish.
And I think that people can be fair in listening to evidence, and we all have opinion. So this is what I'm trying to understand is, where are these people that are not impacted by any opinions outside of when they come into trial? I've been a juror. They ask you questions, and you know that they know that you have perspective when you walk in. No one's saying that you can have an opinion and you can't put that to the side and listen to facts and actually deliberate. You're trying to imply that people can't do that in Baltimore City. That is insulting. I mean, you can have an opinion. Okay, it's on the TV, it's on the radio, but I'm going to go in and look at the facts and discern based on the facts what is fair. Who is to suggest you can't do that?
I mean, the argument of the defense attorneys is going to be that the city of Baltimore, they cannot have a fair trial.
But isn't that what jury selection is for?
But that they're going to say the argument. I'm just saying what their argument is. Their argument is that the majority of the city being black, the majority of black people in Baltimore think the police are corrupt and violent against
the community. That's their opinion. That's not fact.
So that is why that's the argument they're going
to use. Well, I can debunk that argument, because to put everybody in a box and suggest that is the case because you say so is arrogant. Jury selection, that's why you question jurors, you go through the process, and you actually select a jury based on you get, you know, it's a whole process involved.
Lawrence. But, you know, there is the element that, you know, there are, out of the six, three black cops, three mm-hmm. white cops. So, I mean, it can't be that there's a racial mm-hmm. argument, because you're saying black people would have to charge black cops. It's not just like they're all white and you have a rabid group of folk in Baltimore that will never accept these six white cops, because there aren't six white cops. The toughest charges are against the black cop. So, in fact, what you would have is that citizens in Baltimore would be looking at the institution of policing as it's reflected in the actions of these six cops. And the most damaging charge doesn't come against the white cop. It's against the black cop.
Who was driving the van.
Right. And Baltimore jurors are eminently capable of deciding the facts in this case.
Thank you.
To suggest anything less is uncivilized.
It's implying something that I don't
want
to
say. It would be uncivilized,
and this will be taken. And this is going to happen on uncivilized, exactly. So this will be taking place on Wednesday, and we'll see just where this goes on. And that's why the folks, you can join us here tomorrow, where you have two attorneys kind of going through this together and seeing what this may mean and what the legal facts are, what court cases have happened, what's happened in the past, who this judge is. We'll hear a great deal tomorrow from the two attorneys who know a great deal about this and what this may mean. But this is. This is a very, very, very critical moment for the city of Baltimore. We're at a precipice, and we'll see where this takes us. I think we're all very nervous and worried about where this might take us as a community. Following up on that, I mean, this has got to be part of the mayor's race.
I love the way you just slid that. That was good, Mark.
That's what I do. So this is a part of the mayor's race. It's going to be a part of what goes on. The police and community and police are going to be a deep part of this campaign. We know that Sheila Dixon's running. She was on here last week. We know the mayor's running for re-election. She's on here tomorrow. And now we're hearing Nick Mosby is very seriously considering jumping into the race. Some people from the inside say he is running. Catherine Pugh. Many people
she
who know
back
her
in it.
Say she is running.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Carl Stokes, people around him saying he is running. So.
Hope Joe Carter runs.
And Joe Carter may be running.
Yes.
And so what does that mean for this city race if all those people are in it? Does it mean then that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is reelected, gets reelected?
I'm going to concede to my brothers on that one.
Hey, the more the merrier. We want to give people options when they're choosing leadership for a new era. And hey, if anybody wants to run, it's a wide open field. There's never a better time to run for office in Baltimore City. And I think there may be some people who can make some impact in these races. I would say look for Sheila Dixon to make a very strong run. Catherine Pugh has done some great work in the Senate, and she can make some progress and some inroads as well in some of the Baltimore communities. Will everybody necessarily split their vote and allow Stephanie Rawlings-Blake to come back in? That's a possibility. But what's the alternative? You know, I think it's best for the people of Baltimore to have a lot of options on who to choose, and the campaign will have a natural way of withering out candidates.
Right, it'll be intense. I mean, these people who are running, who have run before, have all lost before. The only two candidates who have run this race that have won before are Sheila and Stephanie. And the others have all made the run but not made it. Not Nick Mosby has made the run. But then again, you know, Nick Mosby married to Marilyn Mosby. How that would affect people in this city and this election. What are your thoughts? And what are your thoughts out there? 410-319-8888. Who would you vote for? I'm curious what you think of all these candidates.
You know, what keeps coming to me is I'm from D.C., and I was in D.C. during the Marion Barry era, okay? And as I think about Sheila, I'm so reminded of Marion Barry. Like, whatever you wanted to say about Marion Barry, D.C. loved Marion Barry. They just did. And so, you know, he did what he did, and he got elected. I'm just... Yeah, I think Sheila is this wild card. She's one of those people you cannot count out because there's some allegiance Baltimoreans have to her that is just like, that's going to make the whole game interesting. No matter what about the gift cards, whatever. It's like something about who she is resonates with the citizens of Baltimore. And I think Catherine Pugh does too, but I just don't think she's been able to harness it into a successful win. It's something about, I don't know what that is about her, because she really does resonate with Baltimoreans, but they don't vote for her in droves. Stephanie, let me just finish this last thought. Stephanie Rawlins Blake issue, her approval ratings, I think, are on the decline. Is that true? I haven't read them.
Certain polling, yes.
Yeah. Right. And, but she's a Rawlins, and she's savvy in certain ways. So this is going to be an interesting race. And I disagree with the more the merrier. I think they need to get strategic about how they approach this race, because if not, it's going to have implications for who fleshes out and who actually ends up in the top as the top contenders. This is an interesting...
I think that the politicians historically, Lawrence, don't do that. It's called ego. I want to be mayor.
Exactly.
Right?
The uprising changed everything. It upended Mayor Stephanie Rawlins Blake's incumbency advantage. It rejiggered the calculations for people saying, I want to get into this race, because it shattered the illusion that Baltimore is on the right track. And so now I think what you have is multiple people running to say, I want to get Baltimore back on the right track. And I think people are going to be more accepting of a larger field and perhaps an upstart winning the mayoral election, because our problems are so severe. And I'm interested to see what the platforms of these mayors will be.
Yeah.
Because how different will they be? Mm-hmm.
Baltimore's number one problem is hyper-segregation. And so I think whichever candidate, at least in terms of my support, and I would hope for other people in Baltimore, who has a plan to deal with that? Because that's where you get so much of our social ills.
You know, it's interesting, but Stephanie Rawlings, Amy Sheila Dixon, when she was on the show last week, made a huge point when it was raised by a listener who sent an email in of separating herself from Stephanie Rawlings Blake in terms of development by saying she supported land banks to have a different way of development than Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who killed land banks when she came in. And so these are going to be contentious issues inside the campaign, I think.
Yeah.
Housing is going to be a big issue, and that's going to come to the fore.
And policing.
Yeah.
When you look at zero tolerance, and I think both Dixon and Rawlings Blake continued Martin O'Malley's policies then. So I think in some ways those policies will work against them. O'Malley sort of shadow will work against them.
That could be very well true. And I'm going to go to the phones here, but one of the issues, you know, a lot of people have talked about, remember before, Nick Mosby having a conflict of interest because his wife is state's attorney, and that'll come back up in this election as well if he runs for mayor, saying, what will that mean if the mayor and the state's attorney are married?
Okay, and what's the issue?
The issue is that a conflict of interest? Is that too much power on family? You know that's going to come up.
Well, if that's who the voters vote for, what the Baltimore wants. I mean, that's, you know, if we don't want that, then vote for somebody else.
And the election here is winner takes all. So if you win the election with 32% of the vote, you're mayor. You're a Democratic candidate, but that you stand in the mouth of being mayor in this city. I mean, you know, it's, and So that's another kind of piece of this as well. So it only takes a minority, a plurality of the votes to win.
Right. And again, I mean, I really like Jill Carter. I hope she jumps into the race because, yeah. Again, I think the central issue is hyper-segregation in this city. I don't know if anybody else has. I know that the two people that have been mayors, they don't have a platform,
no.
Anything on their platform to deal with that. I'd be interesting to see what Nick Mosby comes out with. But, you know, I think she's the only one that would come up with something that would actually get at the heart of what is fixing and ailing. I mean, what is hurting and ailing Baltimore.
I just had this flash that Jill Carter runs and wins and Lawrence Brown becomes the head of housing. I don't know why that popped in my head. It just did.
Let me I'll go. Take it. I'll take
Let's
it.
Let's go back to the phones. 410-319. Oh, we're taking a break. We'll come right back. Dr. Carter, you're the first caller up at 410-319-8888. And we will take your call as soon as we return. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I want to remind you on the way back to our conversation here, make you aware of an important event coming up this week in Baltimore. I'll be moderating a town hall at the Roland Park Elementary Middle School this Wednesday, just a couple days from now, September the 2nd, at 6 p.m., about testing in our schools. The panel will feature educators from Baltimore City and around the state, and we want you to be part of that discussion that will be airing on this program later, as a matter of fact. To learn more about the event and reserving your seat, please visit MarylandEducators.com/testingtownhall. That's MarylandEducators.com/testingtownhall. That'll be on our website, so please do join us for that conversation. It'll be interesting, lively, and intense. We'd like to have you there as we wrestle with that question. We are joined here to wrestle with questions facing Baltimore and our state. Dr. Lawrence Brown, Phil Tran, and Dr. Ronnie Ellington, and you at 410-319-8888. Going to Dr. Carter on line two.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was listening to your show and enjoying it as usual, and the young lady on your panel made
Ronnie Ellington.
Yes, how are you?
And I love young ladies. I'll take it.
You're very
I'll take
welcome.
It.
She made the statement that she felt to compare Marion Barry and Sheila Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
I take a point of contention with that. Marion Barry, who certainly made some mistakes legally, mm-hmm. only made the mistakes to hurt himself.
Mm-hmm.
Sheila Dixon hurt the citizens of Baltimore. Marion Barry helped the citizens of D.C. for many, many,
yes.
many, many years. Sheila Dixon went in the pocket of the city of Baltimore and stole money. So there is no comparison whatsoever. Sheila Dixon was a thief, and she should have gone to jail. Marion Barry did his time, and he was elected again because of what he did for the citizens of D.C., I'm not going to belabor the point. I just want to offer you my opinion, and, you know, you can talk about it. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Dr. Carter, for, you know, I love a healthy debate on this. But I think the perception of Baltimore City residents is similar around Sheila Dixon in this regard, that they did feel that she made inroads and strides for Baltimore citizens and that she really is committed to the citizens of Baltimore. We can argue about she stole money and gift cards. I'm not going into that. But I think the overall perception is that she was good for the city in certain ways and that the residents resonated with what she did for them. Now, I could be inaccurate in that, but that's what I hear when people talk about Sheila Dixon.
But I think what concerns me about her has nothing to do with the gift cards. It has to do with she supported and continued EBDI in their displacement of the Middle East black community near Johns Hopkins. She continued zero tolerance policing that was started under O'Malley. So the policies, again, that I'm looking at for the current mayor and her as a prior mayor, I think are very problematic. And if people are serious about looking at the legacy of O'Malley and the type of policing that led to the uprising, then I think you have to include both Rawlings, Blake, and Dixon in that legacy.
Except, I mean, a little pushback on that, because mm-hmm. Sheila was on the show jump in here, Phil, please. I mean, Sheila was on the show last week, and when you look at it, I mean, she began to change those policies when it came to policing, as has Stephanie, I will mm-hmm. add, but changed those policies, and fewer people began being arrested under her, and then it lessened as time went on. And I think that what the issue is going to be is how they deal with policing, because policing in the city has become about mass arrest, has become about the rudeness in the community, it's about the brutality. It's about police no longer learning how to be police in a neighborhood and investigating and just being an occupying force. That's what's got to change. The question is, how does that debate take place in this coming election? Who asks those questions to see if it can take place? Because when I did, I'll raise the issues tomorrow with the mayor, but I think that that David Simon, in his latest piece that he wrote, really raises some really critical issues about what happened to the police department in the last 20 years and how and what we have to do to reshift it.
I'd like to add that one of the sleeper issues of the mayor's race and the city council races will be the property tax rates in Baltimore City. Baltimore City tax rates for real estate is about $2.24 per $100 assessed value. Baltimore County, neighboring Baltimore County, is only $1.10. Prince George's County is only $1. And when you have a property tax rate in Baltimore City that is over twice as high as neighboring Baltimore City and Prince George's County just to the south, it really does hurt home ownership, it hurts businesses, and it hurts jobs and employment prospects for people in the city. So I do know that there are certain city council candidates running in primaries right now who are trying to make that an issue and look for that to become one of the top issues of the race, along with police reform, housing. Property tax rates tied to housing, exactly. Mm-hmm. So right. There you have it.
Well, you know, going back to policing for a bit, what didn't stop has been rough rides. What hasn't stopped has been policing, police misconduct. What hasn't stopped has been this sort of war room, militarized, overly militarized policing strategy. So the volume of arrests may have gone down, but the nature of the beast really hasn't changed. So I think that's what we have to look at, the correctional facilities being totally outdated and dilapidated. The Chiefs had to close one of those jails down for being so very dehumanizing in the conditions that it was in. But I think you're right in terms of the property tax as well. But the thing is, why is Baltimore's property tax so high? We end up subsidizing corporate developers, especially in the Harbor and Harbor East, the Michael Beatty's, the John Pateraxes of the city. So I think that's the argument that I'm looking for someone to make, is to say we need to cut the taxes so that we can stop subsidizing these corporate developers and stop giving them TIFs and pilots, and which ends up putting all of this investment in the harbor, but putting very little investment in Sandton, Winchester, Harlem Park, and redlined, disinvested black communities.
And we've had debates in the past, in the show years past, not recently, about the property tax. And there's some argument I think can be made that maybe property taxes should stop being a city and county issue. It should be a state property tax that's evenly divided around the state, so we don't encumber some communities.
Another issue is with all the development in the harbor, it caused the state to lower the funding for education as well. And so like these issues of development end up having these like ripple effects. And the city, when they found out that they weren't going to get as much money for education because of the massive amount of development in the harbor, they're like, oh, we didn't know. And that's what I think that's the issue right there. What do you mean you do not know? These issues have implications for our children. You have to know that if you're going to put millions and billions of dollars in the harbor and not account for that, there's going to be a gap in education. And that's what we're seeing.
Let me raise another issue here. And folks, please join us at 410-319-8888. And there was a report over the weekend that a young man who rode a dirt bike was a police car hit the back of the bike and he broke his ankle, 9 years old. And it's become a very contentious issue in the city. And we talked about this, and you and I disagreed a little bit on this, Ryan, last time we were on the air. But that's fine. I mean, this is going to be part also of an issue, because it has to do with the integrity of community, safety in the community, what we do with our children. I mean, this is a piece that the city's not been able to get their hands around. The police can't put their hands around it. Nobody can come up with a definitive policy or idea what to do about it at all. But you know what's coming up in this election. And this election also is about all the changes in city council. All these young people running for city council. Two members already say they're not running. And there's a lot of young blood out there going to be in these races. So there's a lot that could be shifting. But this will be one of the issues. Lawrence?
You know, again, I think the question is policies. When you look at the fact that recreational centers have been closed in Baltimore, fire stations have been closed, but yet we're giving billions in tax funds to the corporate developers, you know, then I think, what do we expect that children will do, or what do we expect young people to do when we don't have recreational facilities available, when we're establishing curfews that end up having more of a punitive effect as opposed to more of an effect where we really I don't think we should have a curfew to establish that would put people into this criminal justice system that we have. I think Baltimore is broken fundamentally, and the root cause is segregation. Until we have equitable development in all communities, we're going to continue to see the sort of issues that we're seeing. When you don't have rec centers, you're going to have a lot more crime and antisocial behaviors among youth. When you don't have jobs, when you don't have development in other communities, you're going to have a lot more unemployment. You're going to have a lot more people that are really disinvested and that feel disrespected. And I think that's what we have to address in this city. How do we make sure that the benefits and advantages people enjoy in Roland Park, Homeland, and Guilford are enjoyed in Harlem Park, Sandtown, Winchester, and Middle East? That's what we have to figure out.
Phil, anybody want to jump in before we open the phones here?
Open phones.
Folks, please do join us. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Gene. You're on the air. Welcome in Pikesville.
Yeah, I just turned the radio program on, and good morning to everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
And, you know, the kid who got hit by the bike and by the bike and broke his ankle.
Yes.
It's like a 9-year-old. I'm sure he didn't purchase that. Didn't his parents purchase that? And wouldn't they be liable? How can anybody be held responsible for it but the parents?
That's a good point. I mean, a 9-year-old did not buy that bicycle, without a doubt. So his parents bought it. Older brother bought it. Older sister bought it. Drug dealer bought it. Somebody bought it.
A lawyer bought it?
What do you mean a lawyer bought it?
Why we got to assume it was a drug dealer?
That's one you picked up on. I just named 5 different people who might have bought the bike. It wasn't him.
I was just saying it could have been a lawyer too.
But for us to be naive and do not think that some of the gangs in our city and young people in our city who are involved in the trade are not buying dirt bikes for young people doing work for them is naive.
Oh, certainly a possibility. Yeah, certainly a possibility.
So that is part of is part of who could have. I mean, anybody you talk to in the street will say the same thing. So who bought the bike for this 9-year-old? I don't know. And so, I mean, if that was my 9-year-old, your 9-year-old, and they're riding a dirt bike through the city of Baltimore, what would you say to them?
Well, if my 9-year-old wouldn't be riding a bike.
Okay. You would. That's a little dangerous.
Not mine. But, you know, again, I think, you know, Ceasefire was a program that where the police would offer services and opportunities to gang members and people that were committing violent crime so that they could get away from that life of crime. That program was underfunded, but it's and hasn't been implemented correctly. But you need that type of program for something like the dirt bikers as well. You need a program that will say, here are other opportunities. Here is a place where you can go and ride your heart out. Here, we will block off the street and we will supervise you, but we will let you do this on Sundays and as long as everyone is going to ride in a safe manner. So I think there are ways where we could be working with them, but instead I think we're setting up these sort of checkpoints. Now instead of going through the area where they normally go through around Drew Hill Park, they were near downtown yesterday, and so at night. And so it's like you end up setting up a domino effect, because now you're never going to catch dirt bikers unless you do what this officer did yesterday and you hit somebody, which is the danger of chasing them. So the issue has to be like the police and our leaders ought to be smarter than this. But we can't be smarter when we're not investing in programs like Ceasefire, when we're not investing in recreational centers, then we're setting up ourselves for a situation where people are going to be out of control and we have no way of dealing with it.
I'd like to mention that there's been discussions about building a dirt bike park in order to accommodate all the dirt bike riders. Here's an idea. Instead of building a new dirt bike park, why don't we just use some existing facilities and breathe some new life into them whenever they're not hosting events, like Pimlico, for example.
Hmm.
Wouldn't that be a...
Somebody brought that up last week, and I think there was a logistical issue.
Pimlico is a horse track. It's not built for dirt bike racing. I mean, when you look at what people who are on dirt bikes do is they... I mean, it's be able to pick up the speed, make jumps, go over things, do your wheelies around this. And the dirt track is not – that race horse race track is not conducive to that. People have mentioned that. That's not the place. I mean, some people have said maybe you should build it in Druid Hill Park. I want to say like a Baltimorean. Druid Hill Park. Or you can –
Druid.
I mean, or to kind of build it someplace else. I mean, there are arguments to be made for that. I mean, these young people do have bikes. Not all of them will get off the road, but a substantial number might if they did that.
I've been thinking about this. I mean, you know, I was on the show last time. We talked about this dirt bike issue. The thing, and I think I want to just reiterate what you're saying. As long as we're not criminalizing children, I'm cool with that. I mean, really sitting down and rolling up our sleeves saying, they're going to do this, and you trying to police them to not do it, is not going to work. So then we sit down and collectively strategize about how are we going to address the issue without the criminalization of the children. That's my biggest thing. Because what I feel is now happening is that we're building up this dirt bike conversation. Oh, it's a problem. Oh, is it? So then by the time we swoop in and start arresting kids for being on the bike, I mean, I know how the media works. It's like we create this problem and then we say, oh, it's a problem. And then we criminalize it and start extra policing. And then it becomes, now we got rid of the problem. So I just want to make sure that in this discourse, that's not what we do.
And to be fair, people have been killed after being struck by a dirt bike here in Baltimore. So, I mean, as a public health practitioner, I think, you know, we have to look at both sides. We have to understand
that people have been killed. That's not fair.
Right.
People are killed in auto accidents. I mean,
I'm saying is it's not risk without risk. So, to allow the dirt bikers to ride is not without risk.
That's not what I said.
I'm saying we have to think about, I think, both sides. Like, how do we make it less of a risk for people who may be hit? And how do we accommodate the dirt bikers? Because this is a part of a culture and a tradition that I think we ought to respect. So I think... how do we balance the two is sort of my concern.
And that's
I think there has to be a way
thinking,
to do that.
Right. There's the strategic thinking. But what I'm saying is that what I don't want to see is us to keep having a conversation and make it more of this problem. Because you know how we do with problems.
But how can you say it's not a problem?
No. Listen to my – let me
finish. But you
problem in the sense that it now has to be addressed from a policing standpoint. Like a you're wrong, you're bad, now we're going to smudge you out problem. It's an issue. It's how you frame it. It is something that kids are engaging in that is less than ideal, and we want to make it ideal. That's how I think, because when you start to frame, language is important. When you frame things a certain way, your response to how you frame it is going to be a part of the solution. So all I'm saying is you make it a problem, you make the kids a problem, you start speaking that way, then when we start policing, let me finish, when you start policing them in certain kinds of ways, it becomes okay.
Nobody's saying, I don't think the argument is that you have to police it all the time. I want to see what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. Get your thoughts in here about this. I mean, I think this is going to be an election issue without a doubt. So your thoughts on how this plays out?
Should I ride my regular bike? And I'm nervous. I mean, I don't have a dirt bike, but I have a regular bike, and I live near Morgan, and I sometimes bike to work. I'm still concerned. I mean, bicycling in the street is always an issue. Now, you're right. When you add this whole element of wheelies and dirt bikes.
And going 80, 90 miles an hour around people's neighborhoods where people live and are trying to raise families and are going up and down Reisterstown Road and all through the city that are – I mean, it's not – you cannot allow that to continue.
Exactly.
You can't just continue.
And all I'm saying is when those conversations are had in certain kinds of ways, it justifies a certain behavior.
Let's take that out of it. Say the police are not the answer to the problem. What is the answer?
But I don't mind the police being involved, actually. I don't mind them being involved. I just don't want them coming out in riot gear. See, when they come out with the overly aggressive response, that's not it. But they could supervise. If you had a more controlled environment and an area where folks could ride and say, all right, y'all come on through. We're going to watch you.
They might.
You know, and have a relationship.
Yeah. So let me get to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Carlos, you're on the air.
Mark, this is Carlos, the local guitarist. I met you one time. I was performing there.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but anyway, I just wanted to say that the gentleman was talking about, you know, dirt bikes not being safe for, I think he's saying, for the viewers and the spectators. And he does have a point about that, but if you compare it to any other sport, like, you know, let's say the Indianapolis 500 or anything like that, or let's even say watching stunt planes, you know, like the plane that went down the other day, you know, trying to do a flip or something in the air and crashed onto the interstate. You know, the nature of the beast of some of this stuff is it's just not safe, you know, whether it's dirt bikes or racing or, you know, whatever, you know. So, and another thing I wanted to say is just that part of the problem is they've waited too long to combat this issue, you know. So even when you set up something, the guys have had the thrill of riding through the streets. It's not going to be the same, and you're still going to have some spillover of the guys that just don't want to go to the track. They'd rather ride in the streets. You gotta do things sooner than later, you know. And they've waited so long.
Right.
I mean, I'm 40. I remember I graduated from Northern. I know about the dirt bikes. It's been around forever. So it's like, How do you combat this issue? It's going to be hard because they've waited so long to deal with it.
Carlos has a great point. It has been around for a long time, and they're only now beginning to want to address the issue, but I think because of all the other madness in the city, which is why they're addressing it now. Let's go back to the phones. A lot of people are calling in now, 410-319-8888. Fulton, line two, you're on the air. Hi, Fulton. Welcome. You there? Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, this is Phil.
Hi. Go ahead.
My comment is that why don't we get all the kids in the areas in the different neighborhoods to represent, to take and represent each community and let them talk to who's important, who's in charge of some things, and let them make a decision, and then we come to a head like that, because that's one of the problems now. We ain't giving them no voice.
You're talking about the young people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
We got community leaders in each community. Let each one of the groups of the young people come together with them and let one of them be a representative and let them have a voice in what they're doing. And maybe that will help calm down the situation.
I think that's often the problem, that young people are not brought into the conversation. They're being talked at and about and not with. Let's get on the call and we'll come back to the panel. Let's go to Alvin. You're on the air, line three.
Hello.
Alvin, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I think what's missing is a dialogue in reference to the mindset of why they ride. And a lot of times what I talk to young folks, the appeal of it being illegal, it being a problem, is what they drive on. And I don't think that it's good that, you know, we may be able to put them somewhere and let them be policed in a certain kind of environment. But then you're going to have to deal with different folks coming from different sides of town that may have beef with one another. But it seems to be that breaking the law is the appeal. Doing what's wrong is the appeal to riding these bikes in the streets the way they do.
Good comment. And let's get one more call in here before we go back to our panel to kind of close out and see if wrap this up at 410-319-8888. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Okay. My name is Cynthia, and my comment is I think it's some racial undertones with it because the guys in the county ride it. When they had skateboards out there, they found a platform for that in the city, which was predominantly, you know, Caucasian guys did it. And any other type of activities that they were involved in, they found a reason to compensate for what they were doing. And they're just pushing these people back up in the corner with no alternatives to do. What do they suggest they do? They can't sit on the steps. They can't gather on the corner. What choices do they have? You know, so I think it's some racial undertones with that. That's all I'm saying, because they make us compensate for anyone else who tries to do something with their teenagers and stuff with them. And they're talented. They had more bumps and bruises with people busting up with skateboards, and now they get ready to put something out there now with the
that little two-seater thing like the police ride where people just stand on it and ride around on two wheels.
Segway.
Where they gonna put that at? I don't know the name of it, but you know what I'm talking about. They have all those kind of little apparatuses out, so, you know, I think they open the doors for stuff if they don't find some way to compensate for these guys doing something with their lives. At least they're not getting in any trouble. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much. Shall we, let's get some closing comments here. Do we have time for one more call before closing comments? Yes? 410-319-8888. Will, you're on the air.
Hi.
You're on the air, Will. Welcome.
Thank you. I heard the mayor of Chicago make a comment not long ago where he's actually going out to the community, speaking to the gang members, speaking to people like the motorcycle riders, to give them a voice, to sit down and talk about why it's wrong and what can we do to try to remedy this. But I think that Baltimore truly needs this. We're in a situation that I've been in that traffic when the motorcycle riders are taking over the streets and people are lives are put in danger. And now, can we get some result from that? I think so. If we take the time to sit down with the people who are involved in these illegal actions and try to make a better way for them so that they understand, well, this is for the community, not just for you. Because everybody that's on the bike and every drug dealer is not the worst person in the world. They're
right.
just doing something that they think they need to do to make a living.
Well, appreciate that call. Let's round this out with our panelists. I just want to get all these callers in who really seriously wanted to get their voices heard on this, and we'll go right around the room. Phil, Ronnie, Lawrence, last few minutes.
We will definitely have plenty of issues to address in the upcoming local elections in Baltimore City. Obviously, the dirt bike issue is one: property taxes, police reform, housing, jobs, employment, economic development. It's going to be a wide open field, and it can be anybody's ball game. I think this is going to be a change election in 2016 for Baltimore City. So some of the people who have ran before and have lost may actually have their best opportunities in their lifetime to actually win and try to make a difference.
Ronnie?
Yeah, I just think all
anywhere
of these
like
issues, I love the way you integrated all of these, because the mayor's race is going to be impacted by the Freddie Gay case and how people deal with all the issues we've discussed. I just encourage Baltimoreans to really be educated about, once these all these plethora of people come out with their platforms, to really be questioning and critical with how is whoever is going to be the mayor going to impact their quality of life, and really hold them their feet to the fire to really be accountable to Baltimore City citizens in a way that I don't think mayor candidates have had to be in the past.
And I think there should be a dialogue with folks riding the dirt bikes. Instead of treating them as criminals, find out, are there any alternatives? Are there any other ways? Because we know we're not investing in recreational centers. What can we do to move our needle in a direction where people have real alternatives and don't feel like that they have to resort to legal activities to make ends meet?
I really appreciate all of you being on this program today. This dirt bike thing has got people's attention, and they really want to talk about it. I think that it's multi-layered, and I'm trying to figure out how to make this conversation back here on the air around this one that takes in all these complexities that is this particular issue. But I want to thank all of you for being here. Dr. Lawrence Brown, who is a public health consultant and assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. Before him was Dr. Ronnie Ellington, associate professor of mathematics education at Morgan State University and community commentator here on the Mark Steiner Show.
And
Phil Tran, who is political consultant and CEO of Phil Tran Public Relations, LLC. Thank the three of you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you all for calling in and getting into this. I think it's really important to hear all of your voices and your ideas on what we're facing, and there's a great deal more coming. Remember, the mayor will be here tomorrow at 10 a.m. to take your calls. So line up, from dirt bikers to police to Freddie Gray and more. Your chance to talk to the mayor of Baltimore tomorrow at 10 a.m. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andrew Melton. Our interns are Manifa Wilson, Calvin Perry, and Sienna Greaves. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or on your favorite podcasting app. If I can say that without stumbling, that would be great. So thank you all for being with us. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Thanks for participating. Take care.